Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Matt, you're gonna have to introduce yourself for the listeners out there, even though you've been on, this is your third time now.
Hi everybody. I'm Dr. Matthew Alford. I'm an academic from Britain. Most of my work is about, do you want a long explanation, Robbie?
I want to get to the point where we talk about you being an activist. Where do you find these rallies? I can't believe, you got to tell me what some of these are like. You have an app or something, you find them?
Hang on.
Okay.
So I'll introduce myself first, and then we'll talk. Then I'll tell you about rallies and things.
Yes.
So most of my work is about the relationship between war and the media. I've got a Substack, which is Dr. Matthew Alford, if anyone wants to find that. And I'm also on YouTube as well, and I do to camera sort of like slightly funny, heavy-handed rant.
I enjoy
the camera, which I've started doing this year for a series called Worst Year Ever, which is about the prospects for full-scale international meltdown later on in this calendar year. I did a PhD on propaganda theory, and I spend a lot of my time looking at the relationship between war and the media, and but the protest. So that's kind of who I am, and the protests that you're referring to are probably been on two in the past 3 or 4 weeks. One was for Palestine, and that was just locally because Palestine's become such a massive issue, as you know, since October of last year, that that even in quite small cities, which are really nothing to do with anything, like where I live, and are usually quite kind of genteel and conservative, there are protests that are being run now. And I suppose you could say, well, you know, what's the point in having a protest in a small city? But I think it's part of showing solidarity for the bigger ones that are being run in, you know, New York and DC and London and other major cities around the world. So I thought I'd jump on that one. They've been good. I think I'd like to like emphasize as well that any of the protests that I've ever been on, I've always been wary, like, not to be taken in by a particular side, or if there's like, you know, in the case of Palestine, like, obviously there is a terrorist organization called Hamas, which is deeply involved in this. But I mean, it's really clear, at least in any of the protests I've ever been on, we are literally given leaflets by the organizers that say no to Hamas, no to Netanyahu. So it's like they're really clear. I'm sure there must be factions somewhere that are.
Hold
more...
on, let me say my joke. Most people thought it was a topping before this whole thing even started happening. They thought it was hummus. That's why they got involved. I was surprised at the number of people that were like, "What side are you on, Israel?" Like, I have friends on both sides, and they were like getting mad about us asserting, "Post your political." I'm like, sorry, oh, hold on. Out of all the followers that my friends have that post a story up about Gaza, out of their drug addict and alcoholic friends, I don't know any of them that would have political power to be able to do anything. And I stated that, and they got mad at me. And I was like, sorry, we never acknowledged in 2019 when 28,000 Nigerians were slaughtered. We never talked about since 2014 till now, over 500,000 Ethiopians have died of starvation and illness. So I just don't know why people choose what to get political about unless it affects them, which I respect your work because you do political messaging, but also you not only bring like kind of like a dry humor to it, but you also kind of try and educate people through a type of comedy sort, which I'm curious how you even developed that perspective. Was it from the propaganda stuff? Like, when did you get involved in politics?
I'll try and answer one question at a time.
Feel free. It's conversation, my friend.
Let me control this shit. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think it is picking sides, I think, is a really unfortunate thing that people feel they have to do. And I guess that's because of social media and just the way the world is and tribal feelings and all that. I really think that the way to proceed with what's happening in the Middle East and many of these other conflict areas is to try and think, you know, what's the next step in the process now, and at the same time as thinking what's a just outcome. And that is that as much as possible is not involving, for me, putting blame and division between people. And like you, I've got friends on both sides in that particular conflict. And I'm not walking on the fence because of that. I'm just thinking, you know, when conflicts are so serious, you really have to treat them seriously and just kind of, it's, you know, sticking up a flag and deciding and sort of saying, oh, that's my team now. I sort of feel that we just sort of have to be, for me, I feel that it's better to try and do something a bit more developed than that. And I've got the privilege of working in that kind of academic area. So,
well, and criticize your own government is the thing. We've made $1.83 trillion of taxpayer money was funded towards weapons towards Israel. Like, and we're not talking about, we live here, or I live here, acknowledge that that's a real concern and problem besides the deaths that are happening, which is horrendous, but our government is still funneling money into that. And that's a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And Britain is the same. You won't be surprised to hear that Britain does have troops on the ground, advisors and all this kind of thing in many of these war zones. Literally, about 4 or 5 days ago, it was reported that the CIA had, I think, about a dozen stations on the eastern border of Ukraine that they'd had there for several years that they'd kept secret, which is obviously part of a provocation to Russia. And also, literally yesterday, I think it was reported that Britain, I don't think anyone knew this before, but Britain has been involved in helping Ukraine to fire missiles as well. So, like, the actual on the ground, I think that there's something similar going on in Israel as well. I don't know, that I can't remember the most recent details on that, but, you know, our countries, Britain and America, are really enmeshed with these warring nations, and a lot of the time these conflicts just couldn't go ahead if it wasn't for these two great powers, the United States and the UK. It's remarkable, really, because both countries, your country and mine, have both declined in power markedly. The United States markedly over the past sort of 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and Britain, of course, even more precipitously over a century. But nevertheless, they are still absolutely pivotal in the major and most dangerous conflicts around the world. The other protest, just because you were asking, the other protest that you that I've been on recently was 2 weeks ago, I think, for Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks and the founder of WikiLeaks, who is well into his fifth year in Belmarsh prison without a proper trial. Which is sort of like Britain's Guantanamo Bay, the worst, you know, the hardest prison in our country. And he's up for extradition to the United States at some point. There was an interesting fact. I don't know law very well, the legal system, but I found out the other day that the highest court that Julian Assange has been has actually had arguments heard in until I think the other day was a magistrate's court, which is the court that you get if you get a speeding fine.
Yeah.
so it's basically had, you know, there have been some hearing of some very limited arguments for a very brief period of time, a day or two here and there, but he's still not even had a trial. And so that actual proper criminal trial, not that he's even a criminal as far as anyone can see, but that criminal trial would occur if he is extradited to the United States, and probably be another at least 2 years process of him in the US, again in prison without out any bail, and in the worst prisons in the United States. Massive suicide risk. It's incredibly important to protect Julian Assange, not just for his sake, but also for the sake of free press throughout the Western world, indeed throughout the whole world, because it sets an example. If we're treating him like filth, you know, that it means that other regimes feel able to do the same thing. Would Alexei Navalny have died from
? Careful, careful. That's a YouTube flag, buddy. That's a YouTube
Oh
flag.
no,
Yeah,
damn it.
don't say that.
Yeah.
Let's
Well,
let me
I'm but I'm on the on that particular thing. I was being on the side of the Western.
I don't care. Okay. Let's I want to ask, what do you think the public perception of politics is when you really talk about it? I mean, obviously you've looked at propaganda and you've looked at various forms, but there's so much of it now that I don't think a lot of people realize, and through our discussions, we've talked about movies that have kind of had a small form of it compared to maybe a larger scale. But what about the media messaging that gets people so divided? I mean, you talk about Julian Assange. In my opinion, he did an American act by spreading a lot of these horrible atrocities that were going on out there. But then you'll people have people that are like patriots that are talking about, no, what he did was a, well, you know, is a crime against the military and all this type of stuff. And I was like, yeah, but don't you want to know when there's some heinous shit going on that should be corrected?
Well, I'm a big believer in creative freedom and in journalistic freedom and in freedom of speech. I may look terribly British, but my heart's American. God damn it! I really believe in all that sort of thing, and I think that Julian Assange does as well. And I think that's it's one of the reasons that the topic's close to my heart, because I think that if you do have free systems of communication, and you try and break down boundaries of ignorance and give help people to understand things, pick through arguments, get a more educated population, then you get a much safer and better civilization. And that's what we're, that's ultimately what we're all trying to do, I think. What we're all, anyone with a heart is trying to do. So that's what I believe in. And I guess that's one of the reasons that I've always sort of found politics quite I don't find
Interesting.
politics particularly stressful in a way,
Oh, really?
because in a way, no, because it's just saying, it's just trying to be true to human decency and true to yourself. Do you know what I mean? And just like
I
expressing
don't know.
yourself.
I saw a person at a gas station scratching off one of those F Joe Biden stickers, and they were really going at it, like going like that. And I was just dying laughing. I was like, I never in my life have I ever been like that concerned with like a sticker on a gas pump to
So
scratch
he
it
was
off.
taking it off someone else's.
Oh, he no, it was someone. They've put them up all in our town. They have, I mean, it's everywhere, any state really. You can find F. Joe Biden stickers that are on the gas pumps. And there's like people that are Biden supporters that are just like scratching it off furiously, going to different gas stations, trying to find all these stickers. They keep replacing them, but I'm just like, I've never cared that much about modern day politics in more of a historical sense.
Yeah,
But I'm
yeah.
also a deep state believer, which a lot of people don't agree
Yeah.
with.
Yeah, well, I mean, the deep state is just, it's just sort of bureaucratic theory, isn't it? It's just the idea that there is a civil service that's not very accountable. I mean, the deep state isn't necessarily a great deal more than that. I guess it also comes with kind of connotations of that there is more kind of hidden government, hidden processes. But I mean, it's pretty obvious that that does happen. Not everything's going to be accountable, is it?
Well, how do you think people should be viewing media and how they report on certain stories? I mean, looking at media yourself, I mean, do you look at like anything on the news? Would you call that reliable and respectable? I mean, I don't necessarily think that we have any reasonable outlets for media when it comes to reporting.
Well, I mean, that's quite a sort of old-fashioned question, really, because these days most people think that with alternative media they can find any news information that they might want to. But I kind of think that's a bit of a myth, because although there is a lot of alternative information sources out there, it's also, first of all, if you are going to alternative information sources, not only is there the problem of reliability, but there's also the fact that you might well be quite atomized by that. That you could, you're not actually joining the benefit of the mainstream is that there's so many people who are believing the same thing, and so they have huge strength in numbers. So I think it is quite, yeah, the alternative media is useful. It's a good tool. It's almost like a brilliant library, or brilliant and unreliable library, if you like. Brilliant and unreliable mega library in the internet and alternative sources of information. But it doesn't really solve the problem, because the problems within society really are ideological, and they're more deep set than just, you know, a few people getting the right information at the right time. I mean, it's even like, say, even if you knew the exact answer, including the trajectory of the bullet and everything for the Kennedy assassination.
How dare you?
Even if you knew that exactly and you had the piece of paper to prove it, if you went, how would anyone even know? You'd put it out on the internet.
I'd be killed by a Clinton in like 2 seconds. I'd be killed by a Clinton in like two seconds.
But that's the point is that the alternative media can't really fix a lot of things, because just by the nature of it, it's isolated people that are away from the main planks of power. So, the technology doesn't really solve the problem, but solve political problems. And the main political problems I'm concerned about tend to be issues of war and peace. I mean, the internet has not changed the nature of war and peace. There are just as many and just as severe wars around now, probably much more so because of the dangers of great power conflict, or indeed even superpower conflict, than, say, 30 or 40 years ago. In fact, there was a period in the sort of late 70s, early 80s when there was real prospect, perhaps, of there being a real drawback of a drawdown of American militarized power in the wake of Vietnam, because it was just so unpopular with the public, and then possibly again a little period in the early 1990s when it seemed that the prospects for a kind of world peace, or a kind of functioning world peace, perhaps you could call it, was, you know, it looked like perhaps we could have got there, but primarily the West just squandered all that. Anyway, I've forgotten what your question was.
Well, the more modern day version of how we're starting war and conflicts now, which I don't think is ever really going to end, is the fact of that before they used to employ propaganda heavily to get people to support going into wars like Vietnam and things of that sort. Now it just seems like they just do it on their own, and then they just report on like, this is going on right now, and people go, oh, okay, and then they're moving on to something else. Like, I always criticized the American people and even our own government, where when we finally got out of Afghanistan, and it was like, finally, it took all that time to get out of whatever. Then there were Patriot and going into Ukraine, like not even less than a couple months later, it was like, hold on, let's just take a seat on the bench for a minute. And that was an unpopular opinion, because we had to go spread, I guess, a democracy or go save people. And I go, did anybody see Candace Owens when she was talking to the New York Post or whoever was CNN that had her on? And they were like, what's your evidence that Ukraine was a hostile region? And she was like, it's your evidence. And she was reporting on the articles they had written years ago where they were all media outlets talking trash on Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know exactly what you're referring to. The war in the Donbass was being reported on in quite a fair way, because there was much less political imperative about it from 2014. And so, yeah, the state media or the mainstream media was telling the truths that it won't tell now about the role of Ukraine and Nazi sympathizers and all sorts of things, and they were putting it out there. It's just, they were able to put that out there at the time because there wasn't as much scrutiny, you know, post 2022 with the full scale Russian invasion. You know, this, the shutters are completely down, and everyone has to fit completely in line. But that wasn't the case in the aftermath of 2014. Can the mainstream media do any good? Yeah, I think it can, in the sense, you know, like there is still good information there. Occasionally you get bits and pieces of good commentary, but no, I mean, really, they're following state lines, and this goes back to my usual stuff about Noam Chomsky's propaganda model, and, you know, the imperatives that are forcing the news to go down particular ideological channels, which are basically very supportive of the state. And your other question was, do they actually have to sort of tell people tell the news stations what to kind of think about anymore? Is it more sort of subtle? I guess it is more subtle. I mean, there's quite a lot of what John Pilger called propaganda of omission. Now, I don't know whether you should call it propaganda of omission, because I think propaganda almost implies a kind of active role. But, you know, just simply not having loads of important information or putting zero emphasis on that information is a really effective way of just sort of dumbing down a population and meaning that they don't really have the you know, factual information or the tools to argue against a particular policy, no, particularly foreign policy. So, yeah, ignorance is an issue, and who can blame people? It's very hard to follow all these things. You know, I've just got into the habit for all sorts of different reasons of following international politics every day for the past, whatever it's been, 10,000 days, probably.
Well, what have you learned about your own country's government that has kind of shocked you or revealed some things to you that probably a lot of people aren't aware of? From all standards I know, you guys have been pretty secret when it comes to some of your government actions and stuff for the longest time. And I think it's because, I don't know, maybe a more proper style, or maybe we just have more investigative people that are looking into America's shit more because we're just so damn interesting. But the UK, for me, I was always been like, I've learned some things like from history standpoints, but largely a lot of that stuff's kept secret, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, Britain is quite a secretive country. There have been books written on that in the past few years, the prevalence of censorship in this country. We're not as good with the Freedom of Information Act, for example, and we came to using to developing a Freedom of Information Act much later than the United States. The United States has got at least a reputation, and I think it's probably fair, for more openness to discuss between different agencies. There's obviously still a hell of a lot of secrets that are being kept, and those secrets, of course, are bigger because the United States's interests are so much more, you know, even more grandiose than the UK's. But it's got a reputation for generally being a bit more open with the way it does. So, say, take my field, for instance, which tends to be about propaganda and entertainment. You know, I did the book with Tom Secker, National Security Cinema, which was about the role of the CIA and Department of Defense in Hollywood and how they rewrote 10,000 plus film scripts and TV scripts. Now, that was kept very quiet, and they did sort of cover that up, really, for
Thomas
many, many years.
Thomas Swede.
Yeah, Lawrence Seward.
Lawrence Seward.
So he was part of he was an academic who was part of a very militarized system that basically kept all the relevant documentation away from anyone's hands until eventually our group, through a torturous process, eventually got hold of it. But take the British case of the equivalent thing, where, you know, what is the role of the Ministry of Defense? What is the role of MI5, MI6? What is the role of Whitehall, which is the civil service? How do they affect entertainment products in our country? Well, actually, we've only just even started looking at that in this particular area of entertainment. I'm working with a PhD student at the moment on that. And it looks like there are several hundred products that have been affected, 300-400. And that's, you know, we're only fairly early into the research on it. So we're probably scratching the surface there, and the activity of the British government has probably been even more carefully concealed than what the United States did. There was one case actually from this was found way before we did research. It was found about the year 2000, I think, where a prime minister from about 1915, Lloyd George, I think it was, he had there was a biography made of his, a biopic movie made of his life. Around about 1915, and he was the Prime Minister of Britain, and he didn't like the biopic, so he took the film reel, stuck it in a safe, and just left it there and until about 50 years after he died, and then eventually someone found it in about 1998 or something. It's just a prime minister who's like, yeah, I don't want anyone to find out anything about me with that film, so I'll just stick the one copy in a metal safe. And eventually someone found it like about 50 years after he died. So yeah. A culture of secrecy is perhaps even more pronounced in the UK than it is in the US.
Do you believe that some things should be kept secret? Like, it's a kind of a devil's argument there where you're kind of like, I mean, I understand the idea of secrecy. I just don't understand the idea of what they label national security, especially over here. It's getting labeled on everything where I'm like, that shouldn't be national security.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely ridiculous. And it's, I don't know if I'm maybe drawing an artificial distinction, because I think probably both, when it comes down to it, I mean, can you measure the difference between the US and UK in terms of secrecy? They both seem as bad as each other. I mean, in the case of Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, I think that they described, they said, oh, you can't have the wedding photographs of Julian Assange wearing a kilt. He got married in prison. He was married in prison to his lawyer, Stella, about 2 or 3 years ago. They said, you can't have the wedding photographs. And they called it, they said it was security reasons, but everyone involved in the campaign is like, it's not security reasons, obviously, but what we all think it is that Julian Assange's legs in the kilt were so thin that they didn't want it making headlines, didn't want it to be spread out. But actually, as it stands, the last known photograph of Julian Assange is actually taken through a CCTV camera. And it's a blurry image of him. I think he's wearing a mask, actually, because it was during COVID. And actually, as that photograph is being taken, he's in court and he's having the precursor to a stroke. But they don't care because they quite want him to die, really.
I don't get it. Wait, we have more photos of Harvey Weinstein than we do of fucking Julian Assange.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. So yeah,
you're gonna have to explain. Hold on, you have to explain WikiLeaks to people, because I think a lot of people might not even know who Julian Assange is. Surprisingly, I think a lot of people barely know who Snowden is.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. So yeah, just for those of you out there who don't know this, particularly if you're young people, there are important figures, really, of the past 10, 15 years. Edward Snowden leaked thousands of documents which showed that the United States had been very heavily involved in illegal surveillance. And Edward Snowden is wanted for criminal charges. He was a military figure, wanted for criminal charges, fled to Moscow, is now living in Moscow, which I think he's kind of okay about, because his girlfriend came out to stay with him, didn't she? And Julian Assange has had a much more unfortunate ride, where Julian Assange is the founder and publisher of WikiLeaks, which was an organization which in many ways was a lot bigger than what Edward Snowden did, because they acquired from whistleblowers, from individuals in organizations like the US Army, WikiLeaks acquired information like a newspaper would, things like a video showing the US Army machine gunning at least a dozen people to death in Iraq, including a couple of Reuters journalists, with no apparent provocation. And then WikiLeaks published that material. They also published something called Vault 7, which I think you'll probably find particularly interesting, Robbie. Which was the because that was all the that was done in 2017, and that was, I think, the one where the CIA said, right, whatever happens, we're going to get this guy, because it was Vault 7 of the CIA's sort of playbook. It was like how they do dirty tricks and things.
The Terminate with Extreme Prejudice.
I think so, yeah.
There's a manual in the CIA operations about how you deal with people. It's called Terminate with Extreme Prejudice. And it was ways to make a death look kind of accidental. And it was like really good ways to get rid of people that you might want or might be causing problems to national security. It was like falling off a cliff was like rule one. It sounds so maniacal and so conspiracy, but I mean, if you look at Operation Northwoods, that's not a good document for the American government, but that's a real thing that was passed up in legislation, but passed on the desk of Kennedy.
This is one of your really good historical examples, isn't it? Operation Northwoods.
But when you come across a government document talking about ways to take out, like, a, if you could find a team, like Operation Northwoods document goes into, if you can find a team of like kids on a sports travel trip across country, you can down there plan and make it look like it was a provocation from Cuba or blame another country or something like that. So there's obviously messing around in other countries for incentive gain or war premises. But I'm curious to, like, what doesn't get labeled a conspiracy now when you mention it? The Julian Assange stuff can get labeled a conspiracy. Did really all those people die? It's like, well, yes, but nobody focused on it in the media, really. All they've talked about is his either if a trial and maybe subsequent little stuff about him in newspapers afterwards, but nothing about the real crime that was really committed, which was exposing the American people to atrocities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're talking about a conspiracy that's literally running now, it's the conspiracy of the judiciary, of the prison service, of the British government, of the American, with the American government, with the CIA, and with the and of course with the connivance of other governments, including the Swedish authorities. Because that's where the initial charges were not even charges, but that's where other authorities were involved in chasing Assange early on in circa 2010, 2011.
You might have to explain that. Like I said, a lot of people don't know.
Yeah. So
you're just going to have to go. And if it dies, it dies.
What happened initially with Julian Assange was that, he went to Sweden to do a conference and then was involved in he had a relationship of some kind with two women there. And the women went to a police station afterwards after he'd had sex with them on separate occasions and asked the police if they could compel him to take a sexually transmitted infection test. They were just inquiring. They said, are we allowed to do that?
They're honeypots. They're honeypots.
I mean, I don't know the details of the people involved, but the point is, of course, as soon as they stepped into the police station, the police were like, oh, for this famous person who the Americans want for publishing all of this material, come this way, ladies, come this way. And of course, then, sometimes in that situation were like, you know, they had their minds blown because they didn't want to be railroaded by the police in that way, but he was kind of sort of in the system by then, and so that's what the initial that's why Julian Assange ended up walking into the Ecuadorian embassy in the middle of London and saying to the Ecuadorian embassy, will you give me asylum? Because I think that the Americans and the British authorities are after me. And the Ecuadorian embassy was fairly left wing at the time. And they said, yeah, come here. And he lived in one room in the Ecuadorian embassy for nearly 8 years. And then eventually the government changed in Ecuador. And the British authorities went in and raided the embassy. But of course, just to make it clear, any embassy is the soil of that country. So legally, Ecuador was has a little bit of land in the middle of London, and that's where Julian Assange lived for over 7 years.
Then what? So what happened when? Like, why has he been through this long process of like? There's not been any say on his, you know, his court hearings, anything like that. There's not really been any media focus into his life.
Well, I mean, so this is because I guess there's two broad reasons for that. One, the benign reason, which is that, you know, court cases, very complicated law cases, take ages to process. So, you know, just the way it is. But really, no one thinks that. He's a political prisoner. You know, you don't have a situation, you wouldn't ever normally have a situation where someone is in prison awaiting trial for well over 4 years. And also bear in mind that these are for publishing charges. He's not even been, they never even filed charges for anything to do with the, for the STI, for the women involved in that. They just dropped all that, dropped any interest in that. He's being pursued for what everybody accepts is the best journalistic material that that he produced, and indeed he is an incredibly incredibly prolific and celebrated journalist and publisher. He's doing basically exactly what any other normal publication would do, the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Guardian or whatever it is. That's what he is, a publisher. It's just that he's very, very good at it, and he published things that they didn't like. So led to the problems.
What are your thoughts on the press after all this has been going on? And what are your thoughts on the press just in general? I mean, you know, you looked at movies as like forms of propaganda, but when you're really analyzing if anybody investigative is a journalist anymore besides independent ones. I mean, alternative media, I'm very light touch with what they do. I think they're important and I don't think they should ever be censored. But, you know, you have a lot of reporting that has changed. New York Post, if I'm not mistaken, has just recently flipped a 180 on the whole, you know, pandemic subject. They've actually started to support a lot of things that people have been saying for a while, which was interesting. But, you know, you can't just say they're all conglomerations, they're all business efforts, even though there is a lot of that. But the lack of reporting or lack of incentive to report because you can lose your job is a very dangerous thing. So I'm curious what your ideas are of free press or just press in general.
I guess I'd agree really with you there, Robbie. It's the media as a whole, the mainstream media as a whole, has a very strong interest and tendency to omit any factual information that challenges the idea of state, but the idea that the state is good, you know, state sort of state benevolence, and anything that might endanger the credibility of the major companies that constitute the United States and Great Britain. So that's one aspect of it. But then, of course, each individual organ of the media, whether that's Fox News or the New York Post or the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever it is, they have different political affiliations. Which means that although, you know, oftentimes the major things that they all agree on is, you know, let's not say anything too significant or serious about the major imperialist conflicts in which we are prosecuting, but they will have different party affiliations. So the Murdoch press, Rupert Murdoch's outlets, which include Fox and New York Post, and indeed in my country, The Sun and The Times and big chunks of Sky, satellite TV. He is a really hard right military interventionist, pro-royal family, pro-conservative, ruthless and routinely in favor of free market Thatcherite reforms, probably more so than Margaret Thatcher was herself. But then there are other organizations which are much more liberal. New York Times would be one, and the Guardian in Great Britain would be another. And they're in many ways just as censorious, but they are more likely to align with the Democrat Party, in the US and the Labour Party here in Britain. But of course, as you know, none of that really makes a great deal of difference, because over the past 30 years, the whole political landscape has shifted so that the Labour Party and the Democrat Party is very much on the same kind of side for the major issues, including things like state secrecy, including things like military intervention, including things like the persecution of political prisoners like Julian Assange. They tend to be the same conglomerate, and that's ideologically. And that's why I don't like the Labour Party in Britain. And I joined the Labour Party for a period of time when a proper sort of radical socialist was running it, called Jeremy Corbyn. And then I left as just the day that he was booted out, because I don't want, I mean, our next prime minister is, 99% certain to be someone called Keir Starmer, who's the head of the Labour Party. And he'll win with a massive landslide and get rid of the Conservative Party in Britain. And a lot of people, I guess, see that, a lot of really sort of nice, reasonable, middle of the road people see that as a positive thing. Personally, I don't think it's going to affect. It's not going to create a greater justice in the world or even in our country, and it won't affect spending plans or anything like that. So, I think it's just a mirage, really. So I don't care.
Why is there such a division on the royal family in your country? Not amongst the actual family, but just people that either support the royal family or think it's a bunch of bullshit. Like, I've talked to both sides on that and heard, I mean, like I said, they just whisper it as like, oh, I don't like the royal family, or they'll say something like, I support the royal family, or they like it. And I'm just like, why are you guys so divided on that? It's like the Trump stuff. There's the MAGA people and then there's the un-MAGA people.
The royal family is a bit of a, I'd say, quite different to the Trump thing, because if you know the consequences of Trump getting in,
everybody won't shut up about them. That's the problem.
But you know, that has real implications. The royal family is much more of a decorative thing, although they do, on the quiet, still retain some interesting powers. So I mean, they rarely use it, but for instance, whenever a bill goes through Parliament, the monarch can actually rewrite bits of that bill if he or she wishes to do so. And there's all sorts of like minor, well, not minor, but sort of maybe not used very much sort of hangovers from the imperial past. The Queen could have commuted a sentence of, I'm trying to remember it now off the top of my head, but there was a famous case from the 1970s where there was some violence, I think, in one of the Caribbean countries, and she could have commuted the sentence of the rioter, because it was a political statement he was making, and she didn't bother. She just saw him hanged instead. So there are things that the royal family can do. But to get to your question about why is there a division over whether people like them or not, I think I guess one answer to that is that there is a class question, you know. So people who are more socialist minded will just not like the royal family on principle. But then there's the question of, but you know, we kind of know that sort of, you know, story. You know, if you're anti-establishment, you're probably going to be anti-royal or whatever. But then there's perhaps a more interesting one, which is the fortunes of the royal family over time. And I think that often depends on the PR, the public relations, and how effective that is by the royal family itself. And there have been periods where the royal family is really, really good at doing PR or propaganda, and there have been times where it's just absolutely dropped the ball horribly. So for instance, it was I'll give you a couple of examples, and I don't know if you've got any other points to make about it, but in the 1990s they were doing terribly, and this was because of Princess Diana, because everyone loved Princess Diana, and it made the royal family look really old and staid and set in their ways and conservative and mean as well, because they kept on briefing.
That's why they killed her, I believe.
I was literally watching a documentary about that last night, and I find that a really, really interesting question. Yeah, there's loads of great evidence on that.
My grandma didn't say shit about politics, but she said, I think they killed Princess Diana.
She
almost married a JFK Secret Service agent, too, and I've never heard her say a word about it, but the Princess Diana thing I heard her talk about.
Let me just finish answering the question. But then as soon as Princess Diana died, it kickstarted a new kind of PR campaign by the royal family, who presented themselves as very modern. And this was extremely effective. So their approval ratings, from being extremely low as soon as Diana died, shot right up as they showed themselves to be more human and modernized in many different ways. And this was... And of course, that's you might say that, you know, the fact that Diana was out of the way might have been a motive to have got rid of her, because, you know, it did pave the way for them to have about the next 20 years of actually being scandal-free and very, very successful. And it wasn't really until they started to get more... there were some minor scandals, like Prince Harry went to a fancy dress party in a Nazi uniform, but and a few things like that. Did you ever see that? But it was just in a way, I don't blame Harry for that. He was about 20 years old. He was just, you know, he was just raiding his grandfather's fancy dress.
He didn't know he was wearing Nazi regalia.
Yeah, it was a stupid thing to do. But, you know, but there was obviously there were scandals like that. But really, the overall image of the royal family hadn't declined. And in fact, with Harry and Meghan and William and Kate being the future, the latter two being the future king.
Hang on. I went to a party as Charlie Chaplin. Everyone kept calling me Adolf.
Yeah, that would have been a good excuse.
Just why is everybody saluting me?
And when they were as a group of four people, the royal family was really riding high, and this was perhaps 5 or 10 years ago. So it's only really been the last 5 years when the fortunes of the royal family have really taken a downturn, and that was to do with Prince Andrew and the disastrous interview that he gave to British journalists on Newsnight, which was about the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. And of course, then also the falling out of William and Harry as the brothers who are in line to the throne, and Harry just leaving the royal family as a firm completely and moving to the United States. So there have been a lot of rifts there and a lot of major scandals. So it's kind of come full circle this past sort of 30 odd years from a period of sort of real terrible catastrophe because of what Diana was doing, which was effectively setting up a kind of second court, if you like, in the late 1990s, to great fortunes of the royal family and really accepted, and now back around again to really their reputation being really quite poor again. And of course there are then not just reputational problems, but King Charles is currently suffering from cancer, and Kate Middleton, the future Queen of England, is also in hospital and has been for several weeks and without anyone briefing about it, which means that a lot of people are saying that although it's not a fatal condition, she's extremely unwell. I don't know, someone said an endometriosis or something like that, I'm not sure. But so the royal family is having a lot of problems at the moment and has done for the past 5 years, but previously not. Though, I mean, just to highlight a couple of other things as well. I find the royal family quite interesting because it is such a peculiar drama. But in terms of like the kind of privileges that they retained as well, it was only in the early 1990s, so very much in the modern world, where the government of the day said, do you think that the monarch should start paying tax? They hadn't paid any tax before, income tax. And eventually the Queen reluctantly said, okay, I'll pay tax. But I don't think she or the current monarch, King Charles, even actually says how much they pay in tax.
Gosh, she's so lucky she's not over here. We fucked over Wesley Snipes when he didn't pay his taxes.
So that kind of thing is... So the royal family are really interesting. Even though they've only got symbolic power, in theory, in practice, they have a lot of really interesting, intriguing, sort of quite sinister privileges and powers and loopholes. And if you are a believer in the Diana conspiracy, which I certainly can see why people are, then the kind of power that they are enacting could be even more so. I'm going to continue to look into the Diana conspiracy because I do find it particularly interesting, and I have written a piece about that on my Substack if anyone does want to take a look.
That's why I asked.
Which is as simple as I did it. I try not to use any names, if you see what I mean. Like, I just try and keep it so you can hopefully read it without having to reread it.
Do you think it's the optics that people really enjoy? Like, we talk about ideological reasons why people choose what they want to believe in. I mean, do you think a lot of this stuff, like media politics, the bread and circus, I mean, do you believe in any of that? I do believe that a lot of this is like just the way it looks, is why people tend to get hooked in, and they don't ever really try and be supportive. Like being an activist like yourself, where you're actually going to protests, and even if it's a small one, that's more than most people will ever think about doing, just because a lot of people don't want to go that extra effort to do that. They just want to see something on TV and be like, I support that because this fits what I like or this looks nice. You know what I mean? Reality television is a big capture part of our culture.
I agree with you. I would say one thing I'd like to say about that is that I think if you don't go on protest, I wouldn't call myself a big protester at all. But I show up if there's something that I can get to, and it's, you know, and I think that's quite a good attitude to have to protest. Like, you don't have to buy absolutely everything that's involved in it. And just have a good time, go out to it. It's like, it's worth doing. Like, I took my friend just a couple of weeks ago. It was the first time that he'd been on a protest, and he didn't really understand that you're meant to go there and have a good time. He was like, well, you know, this is about Gaza. We should all be like really glum faced. And I was like, no, just have a good time. This is where people turn up on stilts. This is where people wear masks. This is where people sing. This is where people, you know, maybe they'll stop and have a coffee and what, do you know what I mean? It's like, they're good fun carnival events. And so that's what I'd encourage people to do. And the reason I said, one of the reasons I say that is I remember when the Occupy movement was on, which was Occupy Wall Street, which is sort of anti-capitalist. And there was a local one in my town. And I thought, well, I could go there because they've, you know, they've got three free cans of cider. I could so I'll go there so I can have a drink. And, you know, it's a really negative reason to go. But at the same time, I thought, well, it's just nice, isn't it? And of course, it led me to be much more involved in that process. And then I did something similar with XR as well, Extinction Rebellion. You sort of turn up because, you know, people are friendly there, and, you know, maybe someone's having a cigarette or whatever it is,
or a beer,
you know, or whatever I was doing at the time. So I would encourage people to do that. Just break the spell of it and just go and see what's going on, and then get more comfortable with it. And you don't have to be an ardent believer in any particular thing, but it's just sort of showing that you care a little bit, and it's easy, then go.
This is a challenging question, but what do you feel about comedians being like these kind of political voices now? Obviously, Bill Maher, Jimmy Dore, all these people. I respect Bill Maher's work. I think he's very balanced, and I wouldn't consider myself any party at all. But hearing him speak about things, at least he's open to the opposing views. Now, he does hit it with a little bit more criticism. He's very anti-Trump, which is just like, dude, if you say Trump every third word, I can't fucking listen to you. I don't care about Trump. I don't want to hear about him anymore. I don't want to hear about Biden either. But it's just his takes on things are very rational, very realistic, very kind of, I would consider, approachable, more than what you would get on like Anderson Cooper on CNN, or if you had Tucker Carlson on Fox. There was very one-sided, like they basically are talking trash on each other. And I really appreciate more of a balanced approach, like hearing Joe Rogan talk about some things with like Tulsi Gabbard and others. I like to have these discussions, but what are your thoughts? Like, because I don't know if we should be getting our messages from comedians now. You know what I mean? Like, there should be a better rationale or a better take, honest debates or honest discussions. There are sites out there that do that, but they're not the mainstream.
There's an amazing book in 1985, which I'm always reminded of, by an American social critic called Neil Postman. And the book was called Amusing Ourselves to Death. I thought that's quite a nice title. It had a picture of President Reagan on it with a red nose superimposed on him like a clown. And his point was that basically dumbing down discourse in society, and the kind of the simplification of language. And I think that the comedians are kind of part of that process, really, the talk show host, where because they're good at communicating, that's the reason that they are there, really, that they are fulfilling an ideological role because they are good communicators, in the way that we don't so much need or want sort of serious news anchors, sort of Eric Severide or Dan Rather, or whatever. We don't really crave that so much anymore because we're in a just for fashion reason. But I don't know if I'd really separate what the talk show comedians do. I don't know if I'd really separate that particularly from what the news anchors do, because ideologically they're the same kind of gamut of views. Politically, they're the same kind of connections. presentationally and they're oftentimes they're working in the same studios even. Do you know what I mean?
That's what Bill Maher said. He's like, because they do film The Price is Right, right where we film this show. And I was like, that's crazy.
Yeah, so it's all part of the same sort of circus, really. I guess it's just that comedians, the style of comedic speaking is a bit more resonant with modern audiences. They just happen to be good communicators. So I'm not sure if I see it as necessarily a particularly good or bad thing. I would say that it is part of the process of kind of attention deficit economy where, you know, as we know from doing online things, you know, a lot of it is about trying to talk in headlines. I mean, that's why, oh, sorry, I was about to mention Donald Trump, but there's a certain candidate who is extremely good at talking in sound bites. But I'd say he doesn't even talk in sound bites. He talks in headlines. He talks in tabloid headlines. And
it's because reporting was when he was in office, and they realized that once he was out, they had to keep reporting on him. Which, look, I don't want him as a president because I don't want that in my president speaking like that. But we've really never had anybody that has called out the system or called out and made a mockery of politics, which I think is why comedians are getting such support, is because they are mocking a lot of the bullshit that goes on.
Yeah. I think
if Biden did it, I'd be supporting him, but I don't, besides ordering ice cream and
eating.
He's
not much of a communicator, is he, Joe Biden? Certainly not the last few years.
But Kamala Harris speaks in witch cackles. You ever heard her talk? She's throwing curses on people. I'm just like, Jesus.
Yeah, she's got a very peculiar way of speaking. I think she called for a ceasefire yesterday, didn't she? I was just wondering whether it might be. I haven't looked at the papers the past.
Did she really? Come on now.
She said she wanted a ceasefire in Gaza, and I wondered if it might be that someone somewhere or a group somewhere is lining her up to replace Biden before the election.
I don't know if they want her up there, though, because sometimes she says some stuff where it's like, what do you stop laughing? It's weird. It's scaring. It's like when Nixon talked. Nixon always speaked in like sexual repression. Like whenever he used a speech or something, he'd be like, oh, I forgot who he said. He's like Bobby or Edward. He was like Ted Kennedy. He was a fabulous speaker, astute, very erect in his positions. I'm like, why are you saying that, you fucking weirdo?
I hadn't noticed that, but I do know that they had to censor many hundreds or even thousands of swear words, sexual swear words from Nixon's tapes, didn't they? Because his profanities were just astronomical,
yeah.
Astronomical use of swear words by President Nixon. But and this is why some people talk about Donald Trump as being, whereas someone like Reagan was a television president, Donald Trump is like the social media president, the first social media president, because he's able to speak in these sound bites that's not just kind of cozy fireside chats, you know, feeling like one to one with the like Nixon with his what was it, a cocker spaniel or whatever, you know, hey, yeah, look at my lovely dog that I brought
beagle,
to the
wet. Beagle, yeah.
Yeah, Beagle. So he was a TV president. Reagan was a TV president. And perhaps Trump, with this very clipped way of speaking in a sort of abbreviations, almost is speaking in headlines is the nice way of putting it, I think. He's the first social media president.
Well, getting to like some wrapping points here, but how do you want people to look at politics when they come across it, either on the social platform or when it comes onto the actual main established media platform? And obviously, they come across a wide variety of information. And I think if someone of the media like yourself, who's also involved in actual events and things that go on when it does come to either it's a rally, like I said, even a small one is more than what most people do. But you've also made a documentary, Theaters of War, which you've kind of examined propaganda, and you might have a different view than the general public when it comes to understanding what they are viewing. So I'm curious what your thoughts on that when it comes to modern politics. And also, what's the purpose of the YouTube there, my friend?
What about the YouTube?
What's the purpose of it?
What's the purpose of my YouTube?
Yes. Who am I talking to? I'm not talking to God, baby.
I thought YouTube in general. I don't know.
YouTube's out there to kill people. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, I can't go on YouTube. Don't say that.
The purpose of my YouTube is to, particularly for this year, is to highlight the dangers of great power military conflict. specifically Ukraine, Russia with the West involved, China, Taiwan with the West involved, and Israel, Palestine with the West involved, which will probably, I suspect I'll end up writing an article about Lebanon as well soon enough, because Israel's threatening to go into Lebanon in the coming weeks. We should have to see if that transpires. So the purpose of the primary purpose of the of my YouTube account is to inform people, hopefully in an interesting way, about the about these great power clashes, because it is the most dangerous period that that has ever been in my lifetime. Certainly since the most dangerous period since 1983, which was when the Soviets thought that there was a where all the Soviet computers said that there was an incoming attack of 5 US nuclear missiles and that they should respond. But one person who was a colonel called Petrov refused to follow protocol and refused to fire back with nuclear weapons. So that was when I was a tiny child. And that was probably the most dangerous moment of my life. I think what we're currently in is incrementally every day the second most dangerous moment of my life.
And how do you want people to view media when they're literally examining across all these platforms?
How do I want people to view all media? I guess I want people to view media critically, but I think the other thing I want people to do is also to not view media, you know, just find out information and then do. I think we are going to require, if people come together in organized groups of left and right and demonstrate concern for international political issues and do things, simple things like write to their member of parliament, write to their senator about their concerns, that can have surprisingly enormous effects. And one of the most obvious examples of that, because everyone always says, well, we went out on the street to do the Iraq war and then they still did the Iraq war. But yeah, okay, fine. But that protest laid the groundwork to prevent further actions, probably against Iran in 2008, which could well have happened under Bush, but also very, very, very overtly and obviously in 2013, when there was going to be military intervention by Obama and David Cameron in the UK in Syria. And all it took was a few thousand people calling and writing to their congresspersons. And just saying, don't want this military intervention. And Obama had to come out on live TV and say, ah, yeah, changed our mind. We're not going to do it. We've listened to the people. Same thing happened in Britain. Exactly the same thing, around about the same time. David Cameron had to stand up and say, ah, yeah, we can't do it because a few people have said that they don't like it. So there's an enormous potential for people power to create a more sensible, rational foreign policy in particular, also domestic policy as well, but that's your business for the United States. I'm concerned about foreign policy primarily, because it's potentially the most destructive. And you know, and a fairly small number of people can make a massive difference.
Beautiful, Matt. Where can people find your links?
So yeah, look up Dr. Matthew Alford on Substack, and that's the best place to find me, because I put all of my sort of best stuff there. But you can also find me on Dr. Matthew Alford or The Writer With No Hands on Facebook and follow me there. That's a really good place to catch me. And then the YouTube's the same thing. Just again, my name, Dr. Matthew Alford.
Perfect. I'm going to link all those in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again, my friend. And thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.